This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Welcome to the briefing room with me, David Aronovich. Come inside and join me in getting briefed on the issues that matter by people who know what they're talking about. And do please let us know what you think by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. And if you'd like, please recommend us to friends, but enemies are pretty good too. And a thanks to those of you who've recently reviewed us, including A Dream, Snog Hodge 1 and Howdy Doody 22. And if Howdy Doody's 1 through to 21 are listening, you can send us a review as well. If this briefing room helps you understand the world, you might like other editions of the briefing room. And given the news from Syria at the moment, you could want to listen to the programme we made earlier this year about who wants what from the conflict. This week, I'm getting briefed on violent crime in the UK. How seriously should we take recent claims of a dramatic rise in crimes of violence? So take your seat in the briefing room. In February and March, if only for those months, London's murder rate overtook New York's. And violent crime seems to be rising in other parts of the UK as well. Theories bred theories.
Social media was stoking the fire, if you like, of this violence.
And it was just this, that, tit for tat.
Drill music, these music videos where they're rapping.
The reduction in youth services.
The policy of austerity.
It is not all about police numbers.
They're sometimes pointing their fingers as though they're holding guns.
It's the way the kids are talking now.
They're carrying knives that are as long as somebody's forearm.
The urban clothing is actually a culture now.
Many claims and much confusion. So what exactly is happening? What really are the causes? And what might usefully be done? Step inside the briefing room and we'll make things clearer. First, let's get a proper sense of the overall picture. Professor Susan McVie from Edinburgh Law School is one of Britain's leading statistical criminologists and she provided this précis.
Only a relatively small proportion of all crime is violent crime. If you look at the crime surveys in which members of the public are asked if they are victims of crime, usually somewhere around 30% of crime is measured as violence. And most of that is measured as petty or trivial violence. In other words, violence that doesn't actually result in any injury. Police recorded statistics are slightly different. Violent crime as measured by the police is usually a much smaller percentage again, somewhere between 1 and 5% of all recorded violent crime is considered to be serious violence. So it is a relatively low proportion and most of us are not at risk on a daily basis of violent crime. We have two sources of information that actually present very different pictures. The general trend in violence, and this applies across the UK, has been downwards. So from about the mid-1990s, from the Crime Survey for England and Wales, we see that there's been a pretty steady downward trend in violence until about 2014. And from 2014 onwards, there's more of a stable trend. If you look at police recorded figures, however, you see a slightly different picture. So police recorded statistics for England and Wales show that violent crime actually increased from 1995 up to around 2005. And we've only seen a decline from 2005 onwards. And then in the last 3 years, the police recorded crime figures for England and Wales actually show quite a big increase in violent crime. The Crime Survey for England and Wales is generally the one that we use to compare over time because it is less influenced by specific things that might change the way that we measure crime. The UK Statistics Authority wrapped some of the police forces in England and Wales over the knuckles in about 2013 because they were not recording all of the crime that they were encountering. So I think the increase in violent crime most recently in England and Wales through the police statistics is most likely to be as a result of the police forces getting their act together and actually recording all the crime that comes to their attention. There are some regional differences. There are also differences when we look more specifically at, say, one local authority. So we were looking specifically at Greater Glasgow. And although we found that most of the small localities within Greater Glasgow had reduced in terms of their crime rate, some areas had reduced more than others. And actually, it was the low crime areas that had seen a bigger proportionate reduction in crime. So what that means is that low crime areas have got even lower and high crime areas have only dropped a little bit. If you've got an area that's high in terms of crime, it's also high in terms of victims. And we found when we looked at who had benefited from the crime drop, the people who had benefited the most were actually those people who tended to be just one-off victims of mostly property crime. But when we looked at those people who experienced repeat victimisation, we found that their chance of being a victim of crime had not reduced over the period of the crime drop. And in fact, when we looked at violence, their likelihood of being a victim of violence had actually increased over that period, even though total violence had reduced. What we've seen from the crime drop has mostly been a reduction in those crimes that are probably easier to resolve or easier to prevent. But as crime has come down, and obviously that's something to celebrate at a national level, it's become much, much harder to deal with those really ingrained problems in communities which experience lots of problems. And we haven't found ways of reducing crime for those people in those sorts of populations. We do see flare-ups in crime from time to time, and they often happen in those areas that experience high crime. So in London at the moment, where we're seeing an increase in violence and homicide, there's been all sorts of speculation. I think it's almost certain that whatever's happening in London is a localised issue rather than something that's affecting the whole country. Otherwise, we'd be seeing these flare-ups in other places as well.
As Susan McVie mentioned, there are areas where particular crimes are concentrated. These include certain parts of London. Victor Alisa is a former senior officer in the Metropolitan Police, where, among other roles, he was borough commander of Haringey.
The commissioner was right when she talked about the use of social media influencing and probably driving some of this offending. And if I give you an example, I mean, this was probably about a year ago, and I, as a borough commander, I received a number of videos that were posted, but this particular one really disturbed me. It started off with one young lad with two or three other young lads who look as though they're in the edge of a park at the end of what would have looked like a fencing for a tennis court. And they're talking to this young lad, and it starts off with, "Who are you? Where have you been? What are you doing here?" And the young lad looks, you know, a bit scared. And then it moves on to, "Take off your jacket, take off your jumper." And he ends up when they get this lad to strip bare naked. And then they get him to start jumping up and down while they're videoing this. And it's pure humiliation. And then it moves on to them attacking him with weapons. This is horrifying. You know, if I go back 10 years, you know, Grand Theft Auto superimposed their images on the faces of the characters of Grand Theft Auto with their weapons, with the signals, and they were boasting. that had moved to public humiliation and assault. And you just thought, this is happening in public in London, and we're not anywhere near to be able to prevent that. And probably other people who maybe, you know, either not aware or looking at it, not doing anything. Really shocking. And that really disturbed me. And that's the type of thing that was going on being posted on social media.
In what kind of places were this happening, and what kind of ages increasingly now are we seeing involved?
Well, these group of men were around, you know, late teens, early 20s they looked at. But I was getting evidence and I'm getting information of 12, 13, 14-year-olds, you know, involved in the use of these violence. Now, 10, 12 years ago when I was working in Southwark, some of these things were happening. And I often had meetings with the older member of the gang. So as an example, the Peckham Young Guns. And we had a meeting with the older ones and actually just saying, what's going on? How can you control some of these young people? Because it's just becoming uncontrollable and reckless. But now, you know, the conversation I'm having with people, the older members of these gangs seem to have lost control of the younger ones. And the younger ones don't seem to have any sense of reasonableness.
By that, do you mean that the violence is extremely sudden? There's no kind of build-up to it. They'll go in incredibly violently from the beginning.
Absolutely. You know, and there don't seem to be any rationale behind it. And one of the real disturbing things that I saw just a few days ago was a video saying there's a point system. You get a point for stabbing someone, you get a point for, you know, using a weapon against them, you know, and then you build up your points and then you get your grading in the gang structure system.
Is there a difference or a change in the way in which people are using or resorting to weapons?
Invariably, it's a case of, I'm scared, I need to attack you, and I plunge three or four times and I run away. In addition to those types of attacks, and there were people who were actually going and stabbing people in particular parts of the body when they knew it was going to cause the greatest damage. And that's still going on, you know. And you read, you know, a young lad stabbed in the groin area, stabbed in the thigh. And the consequence of that, which is thought through, was that there'd be damage to internal organs. And you have these young men walking around the rest of their lives with colostomy bags and the rest of it. So that's really insidious. That's really worrying. But that type of planned injury in certain parts of the body still goes on, in addition to the frenzied attack that's going on.
Now, I imagine that within the places where this is happening, actually only a fairly small number of people are involved in the violence itself, but that a much larger number of people are affected by knowing about it or by being scared about it. What is the atmosphere that such things create in the communities around them?
It's one of fear. I've got nephews in London, got sister who lives in London, and we have a conversation. She tells me that, you know, her boys are 17 and 13. She won't let them go out on their own. You know, she'll take them from where they want to go and pick them up again afterwards, because she's just afraid that they're not part of gangs, they're not friends who are part of gangs, but they might just get caught in the violence, you know. I have colleagues who, you know, went to university together, mixed heritage family, and, you know, they're speaking to me saying, my son can go to a top university in London, but we're making the decision that we'll go to a university outside London. They don't want to take the chance that their sons, and invariably sons, might get caught up in the wrong place at the wrong time and they're not able to actually protect themselves.
Victor Alisa, and I'll be talking to him again later. What about outside London? Phil Mackie is the BBC's Midlands correspondent.
In Birmingham, levels of violent crime aren't quite what they were 15 years ago, but there has been a worrying increase in the past 2 or 3 years after a steady decline. I think one of the big moments in the city, many people will remember, was in 2003, the New Year's Eve party in Birmingham, where Charlene Ellis and Letitia Shakespeare were shot dead. Now, that was a drive-by shooting. It was a feud between two gangs, notorious in the city and across the wider West Midlands, the Johnson Crew and the Burger Bar Boys. They'd become really in control of the drugs trade in Birmingham by the late 1990s. It led to a wake-up call, really, not just in Birmingham, but across the country. It led to a lot of good work being done. A lot of it at community level, lots of community groups and charities working with young people to try to dissuade them from entering that kind of gang lifestyle. And I can remember one project particularly working very well indeed. It was called the Gangs and Mediation Project. It was run by an ex-police officer called Kirk Dawes, and he worked at arm's length from the police. He'd left the police force, so he was able to talk directly to people he'd met on the streets who he knew were involved in the gangs. And when he heard of an argument that was building up, or a beef between those gangs, he was able to step in and try to mediate between them to find a solution that wouldn't end in violence. And it really had a major impact. And I think a lot of Labour's policy 10 years ago, in fact, the local election campaign was very much dominated by Labour talking about neighbourhood policing. That led to a lot more officers in areas like Aston and Lascelles, inner city Birmingham, where there had been high levels of crime. And really, up until 2012, 2013, it seemed to be a problem that was still there, but not nearly at the levels that it was at before. And of course, priorities changed. Police, local authorities that invested a lot of money in trying to counteract gangs, gun crime, knife crime, started spending their money and shifting resources elsewhere. There were other problems. Cybercrime was a growing problem. Terrorism, and some of those more experienced officers were moved into those areas. Probably around 2015, we noticed gun crime was back on the streets. Some of the gangs, like the Johnsons and the Burger Bar Boys, not quite in the same form as they had been earlier on. They'd been split into smaller groups, often taunting one another on social media using Vimeo and YouTube. I think perhaps the most worrying point is the return of knife crime as a major problem. We saw it never really went away, but it looks like young people who had perhaps stopped carrying bladed weapons are doing so again. And there was a big moment for Birmingham last summer, last July, when four people were murdered, stabbed to death in the space of a week. The circumstances were very different in each of those cases. But nonetheless, it does show that a growing casualty list is once again happening in a city like Birmingham after a long and steady decline. That's clearly worrying the people at the very top. Dave Thompson, the chief constable of the West Midlands, has said he'd struggle to cope given his current staffing levels if we had a similar situation to the riots in 2011. It may just be a blip. Things are nowhere near as bad as they were. It's just that things are constantly changing. And hopefully some of the lessons that were learned a decade or so ago can be put back into action now.
Phil Mackie. So it's genuinely grim in certain places and for certain people. But what are the causes of this fatal uptick in violence, and how might it be stopped? Karen McCluskey of Community Justice Scotland has been working on just that for well over a decade, having founded the Violence Reduction Unit in Glasgow. And joining her is Victor Elisa, who we heard from earlier. Karen and Victor, since this flare-up, if you like, of deaths by knife crime started, we've been inundated with almost kind of tsunami of causes. What do you think it is?
It's everything. It's a wicked problem. Complex, complicated. And you may not get to the stage that you say it's fixed. I mean, I can only speak about Scotland. It was poverty, it was hopelessness, it was alienation. Neighbourhood policing, that's the complexity, I think, that overwhelms people. People want a simple solution. And if there was one, we'd have done it already.
Victor, you've been listening, like I have, to all these causes and so on.
Yeah.
As you've been listening, have you been thinking, yes, it's a bit of that and a bit of that? Or have you been thinking, that's a red herring, that's a red herring, that's a red herring, you really ought to kind of concentrate on these?
I've been thinking some of the things are a bit of a distraction rather than a red herring. And I'll use an example. We've talked incessantly about stop and search, you know, and that seemed at some stage to be the panacea to all the problem. Clearly not, you know. It's stop and search can be effective, but we need to move away from, you know, policing as the solution. I think a number of people have said that. There's a lot of factors. There's got very little to do with policing, probably something to do with social amenities and social services, but there's a whole range of areas. And I guess it's giving those young people the hope and an alternative to give them to be able to control their own destiny. Otherwise, they see everyday life, working hard, trying to achieve as impossible because they don't feel they're going to get an opportunity, they don't feel they're listened to. And the real sad thing is some of these young people come from really good homes with a strong ethic, with a strong parental control. They toe the line, they listen to their parents, were in the family home. But when they step out of the door, it's as if they step into a world where there are no control, no parameters, and they just behave in a really incomprehensible way.
Karen, when you first started looking at the problem in Glasgow, how did you analyse the problems that were leading to such high levels of violent crime?
When we turned it around and started to look at it as a public health problem, like an infection, how you caught it, how you passed it on, you know, the clustering of it, you started to be able to pick up what happened at an individual level, you know, some of the characteristics that led to violence, what happened at a community level, what happened at a parental level. And it allowed us to disaggregate some of the things that we thought we could influence and bring other people in, because Vic's right. If you leave it just to the police, we can't solve it. You know, we needed to bring in education and everybody else.
What did you discover that surprised you?
Lots of people didn't want to be in that lifestyle. See, when you gave them the opportunity of a way out, you gave them a bit of hope and you stopped taking a deficit approach and more of an asset-based approach.
What does that mean?
You started to ask people, you know, what does success look like to you? You know, do you want a different wage? You know, employment? When you actually said to them, do you want to change? The majority did.
So what did you actually do?
We started where we had most traction, and my emergency room consultants were probably the best. We had a bit of a zeitgeist in Scotland. The United Nations had come out and said that we were the most violent country in Europe and Glasgow was the most violent city. And our emergency room consultants were pretty spectacular. They were also saying, look, we cannot keep stitching up these people. You know, we don't want to tell another parent's family that their son's died. And so they started to look at the amount of people who were coming in through violence, so surveillance. And of course, what we found was that only 30% of people who were affected by violence were reporting it to the police. And so when we started, our measure of success was stopping the people coming through the accident emergency room doors. We needed the policing moral high ground, so we tightened up our processes. Great neighbourhood policing. I mean, I am a huge exponent of fantastic neighbourhood police officers. Keeping them in their roles for a long time so they get to know their communities. We had campus cops in our schools, and not to police the schools, but in a way to be good male role models. Because we had a huge amount of young men who were growing up in 21st century Scotland with no idea about what it was to be a man.
So what level of reduction did you actually manage to achieve, and over what period?
Well, so we are 15 years on. This is a long-term solution. We seem to have sometimes strategic attention deficit. We think that everything can be solved within a year. We set out a 10-year plan. We started to look at long-term trends. You know, we didn't just look at homicide. We looked at all violence. So it wasn't just gang violence. We didn't concatenate it. So we are now about a 42-year low for violence. And our murder rates, you know, is one of the lowest since records began.
Now, Victor, you've worked in London and you come from Manchester. When you look at the experience of Glasgow, do you say to yourself, we can apply those lessons elsewhere? Or do you say it's a particular situation and we have different sets of problems elsewhere?
We can't apply some of the methods that have been used in Glasgow in London, but there are different cohorts. In London, we're talking about young people, and we're talking about young people who have this affinity to drift in and out of groups. The public health method can be used for young people because we know there are a number of young people who are part of, I use the term gangs, but it's not really gangs, who suffer mental health problems. So getting an understanding of what they're doing and understanding where they fit in society is really useful. But there's differences, and I think we need to understand that differences and not import.
So to take an example, Karen talked about offering prospects of better employment. But if your knife crime is going on amongst kids of 13, 14, 15, that may not be what's motivating them. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly what I'm saying, yes. You know, so, you know, there are different drivers at that early age. A lot of it would be lack of understanding, lack of awareness of where they are and what their future holds of them. And sadly, for some of them, they don't see a future. If it continues at the rate it has been, then by the end of the year, we're going to have a murder rate of nearly 200. And it's absolutely right that we do something, but we need to find long-term solutions so we don't go through this cycle every 10, 11, 12 years.
Karen, how did you, in Scotland, manage to embed a policy and maintain it over the long term? Who has to buy in to make that happen?
Oh, everybody. You need politicians to buy into this and to come out and say, look, this is going to be long term. So you have to fix this whilst it's moving. Fix absolutely right. You need to deal with what you've got right now. But then we also, I mean, you know, my colleague and I probably spoke to about 15,000 people a year each. We spoke to everybody. So, I mean, we obviously have early years. I probably spend as much time speaking to nursery teachers and parents as I do going to jails. We obviously did a huge amount of secondary prevention, which was teaching bystander approaches in our schools.
What is a bystander approach?
So bystander is, if you hear something, we give them skills about what to do. You know, so if they hear language or they hear someone's carrying a knife, we give them skills about what to do. We taught everybody bystander approaches, and we did a mentors in violence prevention throughout lots and lots of schools in Scotland. I've got a cast of thousands, primary school teachers, secondary school teachers, so it's everybody, and that's what public health's about.
How did you maintain the resources over a long period of time when there was so much competition for the resource and when politicians would have other people saying, we have just as great needs?
When we had a big reduction in violence, someone quite senior who I really respect said to me, well, does that mean that we can take our eye off it now? And I said, well, it's really interesting. Just because you don't have any measles doesn't mean that you stop inoculating people. People like to, you know, they look at the stats at the moment and they think it's absolutely dreadful. It has been dreadful for a long time. It's been dreadful for lots of our communities that are out there who are suffering this, who've had relatives and sons and daughters who've died. And we need to listen to them.
Karen McCluskey. So it looks like it's about making strategic decisions about policing and community health and sticking to them. The BBC's home editor, Mark Easton, has been through several of these moments in his 14 years in the job. Mark, you've noticed some interesting correlations between this kind of violence and mental health, haven't you?
Yes, I think it's true that when you start really studying what's going on with violence, who are the people who are being violent, and then you look back in their lives, there are things that really strike you. There was some work done by the American Journal of Psychiatry a few years ago. They interviewed 4,500 young men in the UK and discovered that those involved with gangs showed, and I quote, an inordinately high level of psychiatric morbidity. In other words, they had significant mental health problems. And the same kind of research produces the same kind of results. There was a brilliant piece of research done in America in which they interviewed in-depth interviews with 16 men on death row and discovered that 14 of them had been severely physically abused as children. So I think that the association with mental health problems and violence later in life is actually quite clear.
OK, now, never mind all the stuff about we've been hearing about music and social media and all the various theories that have rocked around since this first became, if you like, a kind of moral panic. What we've just heard is a pretty convincing case that long-term and strategic action is what's needed. So what I'm going to ask you is, and from your position of expertise, has government bought into the idea of this strategic long-term approach?
So this week we had the Serious Violence Strategy launched by the Home Secretary Amber Rudd, which promised a major shift in policy, that promised a step change in the way that we deal with these things, both in immediate terms, in criminal justice response, and a long-term sort of early intervention kind of programme. So all the rhetoric was there, but I have to say, I kind of sighed a little bit because we have been here before. In 2011, the previous Home Secretary, one Theresa May, produced a document called Ending Gang and Youth Violence. And then in 2016, we had another report, also from the Home Office, which promised to end gang violence. And when you look at those documents, what you discover is that many of the interventions, which were grandstanded at that time, simply either got cut or disappeared.
So let's be absolutely clear. In Glasgow, we've heard a 15-year strategy which has had a long-term effect. And what Karen McCluskey said was, we've convinced people again of the need to maintain this. Are you saying that the history, let's say, in England has been that we've identified the problem correctly and then just simply not sustained the approach?
What tends to happen is that ministers will listen to the experts and all agree, yes, we need that kind of long-term early intervention plan. Money will be pumped into special schemes in areas of high knife crime or where gangs operate, all kinds of sort of fancy titles and bits of paper attached to them. And then you go back so often a couple of years later and it's sort of just disappeared, or the funding has not been secured and it's gone. And it's as the spotlight moves away again from this area, it seems that sort of political interest diminishes.
Karen McCluskey called this strategic attention deficit. From what you're saying, it seems that you would call it the same thing. You recognise that and you don't think it's changed.
Well, I think what's been going on in Glasgow has really actually been a game changer for some of the thinking in other parts of the UK. I know that those ideas have been tried in some parts of London. But again, there's frustration that it doesn't seem to have been followed through. And I think for the politicians, with any criminal justice issue, they feel the need to offer a criminal justice response. It is as though they imagine that somehow criminal justice agencies have a real impact on the levels of crime, when actually, in my experience, and I think there's a lot of evidence to show this, actually, criminal justice agencies don't have a very big impact on crime levels. It's other things that do.
Given that these tend to be quite localised spikes in violent crime, couldn't you reduce this current uptick, which after all is actual people dying, by getting a lot of police in there, being pretty heavy with the kind of people who do it, and at least that would stop it for now.
I think it's true that if you were to flood an area with lots and lots of police officers, stop and search all over the place, you might well disrupt some of that. You might well actually prevent some individual acts of violence that might have resulted in a death. The problem is that you may also, in fact, very likely to infect that same area with resentment and distrust, and actually making the situation a lot worse.
That was Mark Easton, and my thanks to him, Carrie McCluskey, Phil Mackey, Victor Elisa and Susan McVie. We'll be back next week. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich, and produced by Neil Koenig, Serena Tarling and Beth Sagar-Fenton. And please let us know what you think about this programme or indeed the entire series. And you can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. We really do like hearing from you.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
Hello, it's Ray Winstone. I'm here to tell you about my podcast on BBC Radio 4. History's Toughest Heroes. I've got stories about the pioneers, the rebels, the outcasts who define tough.
And that was the first time that anybody ever ran a car up that fast with no tires on. It almost feels like your eyeballs are going to come out of your head.
Tough enough for you? Subscribe to History's Toughest Heroes wherever you get your podcast.